Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Hubert Ritzdorf. Hubert is the co-founder and CTO of Chain Security, a startup focusing on smart contract security. He has been working on application security for more than 10 years and on blockchain security for more than 6 years. He has a PhD from ETH Zurich, and his research influenced the underlying Bitcoin protocol and the main Ethereum client implementation. And now to the interview. Hello, Hubert, and thanks a lot for making time today.
Hi. It's my pleasure to join.
A colleague from ETH Zurich, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, recently introduced us, and he thought it would be interesting to speak with you about smart contracts because you founded an auditing platform for smart contracts recently. When exactly did you start that company?
Yeah, that was at the end of last year and was the output of a research project, actually, that was started at ETH. And while we were doing this research project, people were approaching us and were telling us, oh, this is a really interesting research project you have here. And the project was about, as you said, analyzing smart contracts and automatically finding vulnerabilities in them. And then they told us, it would be interesting if you could offer audits based on this platform that you developed here. Mm-hmm. So kind of driven by the demand, we founded a company in late September last year.
Mm-hmm. Cool. A question about that research project. So there it was about automating the audit of the code of smart contracts.
That's correct, yes.
I mean, in terms of your company, right, what is the USP of doing the audit in the way that you researched in that research project over maybe how other companies in the market approach that?
Yeah, that's a very good question because that's often hard for people from the outside to grasp because you just see people are offering audits and it's not clear what's the difference between all the audits. Mm-hmm. So the difference is that automated research is or automated smart contract analysis is, of course, a lot more reliable because a human, as we all know, makes mistakes. So if you had too much for lunch and you have kind of a sleepy afternoon, you might miss a lot of important vulnerabilities. So that's why it's important to have tools which can help you and which will automatically find the things you're looking for in the code. And in particular, our tools use a technique called formal verification, which is something we developed together with ETH professor Martin Betchev. And the formal verification is a general idea, and we applied it to smart contract analysis. And formal verification allows us to give kind of mathematical guarantees about the correctness of the code. So in a way, we can give a mathematical proof that the code does not have certain vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm. How big is such a smart contract? I mean, how many lines of code do they have normally?
So the regular smart contract that we see, for example, for an ICO, is, I would say, around between 100 and 200 lines of code. And then including all of the libraries, it's between 500 and 600 typically, which is, of course, relatively small compared to other computer science projects or other IT projects.
Mm-hmm. So how many bugs usually do you find in those contracts? I mean, how many bugs per 100 lines of code, for example?
Yeah, that's a good question. That, of course, varies wildly. As blockchain is such a new space. People are coming into it and people are learning it. And some people are already more experienced and other people are less experienced. And of course, the less experienced people are more likely to make more mistakes. And with these less experienced people, we will, I would say, we will find on average 3 to 4 bugs per 100 lines of code. But we also already see the more experienced people that do a lot better, where we, I would say, maybe find half, so to speak, half a bug per 100 lines of code. Mm-hmm. So a big difference. And
it's still several bugs per contract, though, at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's our experience. So we have now.
I mean, have you seen a contract that had zero bugs?
Yes, I was going to mention this. We have now finished 25 audits, and we have had exactly one that had no bugs. So it happens. It definitely happens, but it's very rare. And of course, we try to make sure that after the audit, there's no bugs left.
How many smart contracts that are currently in the market are audited manually by a coder going through the code? Because they're not that big. I mean, I thought they were much longer. I thought there's 1,000 lines of code. But I mean, if it's just a few hundred, maybe it is possible. So how many of those contracts are audited just with a human?
Yeah, I would say the vast majority at the moment. Of course, there are different kinds of tools that some tools are freely accessible. You can also check out the website of the research project that I mentioned before, which is securify.ch. There also you get some free information, and there's many more which are freely accessible. And they just give you basic information. So on top of that, typically most people rely on manual audits. So I would say the vast majority relies on manual audits, but there the big problem is that there's no standard. It's very hard to compare, mm-hmm. and it's very hard to know what actually the auditor has done, because there's lots of freelancers in this auditing market. So there's no standards, there's no fixed best practices or anything like this. So this makes it very hard for customers to judge the differences and also to check if their audit is really good. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did it happen that you ran a contract through your programs and then, you know, in a manual audit found something that the software couldn't find?
Yes, definitely. So how our programs work is they search for, let's say, known vulnerabilities. And so first we have to teach them what they have to look for. Mm-hmm. So in a way, they can only defend against what they know. So over time, as we ourselves got better and better at auditing smart contracts, we also taught the tool more and more. So we saw what kind of errors typically appeared in the smart contracts. And then we automated their analysis so that we would always find these kind of vulnerabilities in the future.
Mm-hmm. Is it a machine learning tool as well?
There's no machine learning involved. So basically, the human is doing the learning part and then is teaching the tool what to do.
How did you originally get into the blockchain topic?
Yes, it's been a while for me. I have to, in my mind, go back to early 2012, mm-hmm. When I got into blockchain for the first time. And at that time, I was a master's student at ETH and was helping with a research project into Bitcoin, and more specifically into fast payments with Bitcoin and how long you would have to wait to make sure a fast payment would actually be secure or not. So that was the first time I really got involved in blockchain topics. Mm-hmm. And ever since I've been fascinated.
What was for you the the moment where you thought, maybe this could be a company that you could start out of that project?
Yeah. So actually, the three other co-founders, so that in total there are four founders in the company, the three other founders asked me whether I wanted to get involved, and they said that they had already been in contact with potential customers. And of course, I was getting close to finishing my PhD, so I had kind of thought a little bit about what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And this just presented a unique opportunity because it combined security, which my PhD topic, which was one of my PhD topics, with blockchain, which was another one of my PhD topics. And also it very strongly reflected my personal preferences. Mm-hmm. So I thought this is too good an opportunity to pass on. So I decided to join and haven't regretted it since.
It was definitely the being at the right place at the right time, right? At the end of 2017.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And also being at ETH is at the right place, I would say, because there's so many interesting things happening there and just so many great minds that mm-hmm. it's always inspiration that can be drawn from there, and so many cool projects that can be started there. And also quite important that we are now recruiting from there. So, like, mm-hmm. I mean, as a young company, of course, a big problem is always recruiting talent and having that physical proximity, but also having the good knowledge of ETH helps us a lot to recruit talent directly from there.
Right. And I think many other companies too. I mean, that's what a lot of people tell me. You know, Switzerland has become this kind of talent hub for blockchain technology because of ETH and EPFL, and because people are so well educated here.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, praise goes to those who started it. I mean, you already mentioned Roger Wattenhofer, with Christian Decker, started very early, and thereby, of course, laid the foundation work. Then Professor Chapkun, also at ETH, people who started early education, mentioning blockchain in lectures and so on, thereby exposing it to more and more people. And this is now, I think it's a great example of how university, in this case ETH, can bring very direct value to the society by mm-hmm. producing exactly those kind of experts that you need.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Do you sometimes have like a bidding war going on for people with Google or the likes?
Yeah, unfortunately, we can't enter a bidding war with Google. this one will be over pretty fast, but of course, we do see this, and we have been on the losing end multiple times already. Of course, we have also been on the winning end a couple of times, where we are quite excited about all the people who decided to join our company. But yeah, it's as a small company with a relatively tight budget, it's of course tricky to attract this kind of talent. But we can offer, I guess, a special work environment and really unique opportunities here. So that's what we're trying to tell people when we're recruiting them.
Mm-hmm. How did you fund the company?
It's actually it's self-funded, so no investors. All of the founders invested put together starting capital, and ever since then it's been driven by customers' revenue, so no investors or anything like this, which is also why the budget is still pretty tight.
Mm-hmm. Did you at some point also consider the idea of an ICO for your own company?
Yes, of course. And we got asked many, many times when people can buy our tokens.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, we didn't do it for legal reasons, to avoid any legal complications. And also because we felt that there was no direct need to do an ICO, because in the end, we offer a service that people people can pay us directly in Ether. And so there was no clear benefit of having our own token, because in the end, what it would mean is that people would have to do an additional conversion from Ether into our token first. So our customers can pay us in Ether, and that works pretty well. So at the moment, we don't necessarily need an ICO.
Hubert, how did you and your founders go about learning how to run a company? I mean, you have a PhD, you're more on the technical side, but there's a lot of business things as well that you have to consider. So how did you learn that?
That's a very good question. So yeah, I would say we learned the hard way. So as you correctly said, we come more from the technical side. In the beginning, issues like pricing and sales and marketing, they were secondary to us. So we wanted to have a great technical solution. And so we really focused on the technical side and really probably left a lot of money on the table in the beginning. But then actually we were lucky enough that we were able to have Matthias Ekli join us, our COO, mm-hmm. who is now managing the business side a little bit and brought a lot more structure into the company. So yes, he had prior business experience in startups, and he has definitely helped a lot to organize. But also in terms of running the company, there's the business side, but then I would say there's also the internal side. There, we and me in particular, we definitely had a lot to learn. So I made a lot of mistakes that hopefully I will never repeat. But it was my first time being the boss of someone, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Even though we try to keep hierarchies as flat as possible, someone had to say in the beginning what's the task now. So I definitely made some initial mistakes that I'm learning from now, and we are already seeing improvements. And I hope that when a member of our company hears this now, they don't completely disagree with me.
Okay, good. What is, for you personally, what has been maybe the biggest misconception about running your own company?
I would say probably the biggest misconception has been how much money is needed. Because in the beginning, I thought, well, you want to run a business, and then maybe there's going to be two people. And then there were clients and they wanted to pay us 5,000 francs. And I was like, wow, 5,000 francs, that's so much money. Because that feels like, in the beginning, somehow you're starting from zero. So 5,000 feels like an enormous amount. And mm-hmm. then you realize you start paying taxes and you start paying all kinds of other things like offices and so on. And then you realize how much money is somehow lost along the way and how much steady income is needed to keep up a company with 5 to 10 employees. And that's definitely a big learning experience I had.
Let's speak a little bit more about smart contracts. You mentioned before that you did quite some work on those two parity hacks that happened. So maybe can you explain a little bit more about your insight there?
Yes. So maybe to set the stage a little bit, there were two critical vulnerabilities in the parity multi-signature wallet. So first, what's a parity multi-signature wallet? Parity is one of the big companies in the Ethereum ecosystem, also developing one of the core Ethereum clients. And a multi-signature wallet is basically a smart contract that lets multiple people jointly manage money. So, for example, let's say you and I share a multi-signature wallet, then the multi-signature wallet is configured in such a way that both of us would have to agree if we want to spend some of our shared money. So I would, for example, propose that we buy a new couch for 100 Ether, and then you would say, no, I don't like this. And then you could propose something else, and then I could agree. And all of these things happen directly on the blockchain, and that's why we don't need any trusted intermediary. So that's why multi-signature wallets can be very helpful and very powerful. And that's also why they're being used a lot, namely to store big amounts of money. Often the money that was raised in an ICO is being stored in such a multi-signature wallet. So they're also a prime attack target. So in the last year, there were two attacks. First, in July, there was a bug where 150,000 Ether roughly were stolen because people were able to take control of the wallets in a very special way. So I just mentioned that only those who control the wallet can decide what it should do. But due to some tricky little bug, others could basically take control of the wallet and decide what it should do. And then, of course, they decided to steal all the money, which was pretty sad because some very cool projects were affected by this. And then there was a second bug later in 2017 in November, where over 500,000 Ether this time got stuck. So in a way, they are now frozen forever in the blockchain because someone managed to destroy the multi-signature wallets in a way. So they are basically unusable now. And because they're unusable now, whenever you would try to take money out now, it doesn't work anymore because he managed to destroy these contracts because, again, they had a bug. So
500,000, that was how many Swiss francs?
Well, at the time, that was around 500 million Swiss francs, I guess. So a lot of money. Now, with the current price, it's, let's say, maybe 300 million. But yeah, still
a
lot of money. Yes, still a great waste. But with these bugs, it's always important to realize that it's not Ethereum itself that's at fault. It's a system. These multi-signature wallets are smart contracts, just regular smart contracts, which are built on top of Ethereum. So it's these smart contracts that had bugs, and therefore they were exploitable, and therefore this money got stolen and frozen.
But there in this wallet, I mean, were they in the wallet smart contract? Was that contract audited or not?
I think it had been. I mean, it definitely had been audited internally, and I think also other people had looked at it before using it. However, the bugs were very subtle. I mean, it were these kind of bugs that, especially the first one, was very, very subtle. That how subtle the bug was can be seen when you actually check online for how it was fixed. So when the first bug was fixed, actually just basically a single word was added to the code, and then the code was fine again. Well, that's at least what everyone thought until the second bug came around. But the fixing the original bug was relatively simple, and but also shows that these extremely subtle issues can have an enormous impact, which is why I said earlier that automated analysis is so important, because these things can be easily missed by a human.
To hack such a smart contract, what kind of skills are necessary? Let's take a quick break for a message from our sponsors. This episode has support from no official sponsor, but from my very own, the Blockchain and Us newsletter. get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes, so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. To hack such a smart contract, what kind of skills are necessary?
So in a way, hacking a smart contract is easier than, let's say, hacking a web server or a website more specifically, because the way blockchains and smart contracts work is you can see all of the code. So whereas with a regular website, most of the times you will not know what kind of code it is running in the background, which makes it harder for you to hack because you don't really know what you're trying to break here. With smart contracts, you can see the full code. So you can see exactly what the problem is. So in the security term, this is called a white box analysis, whereas otherwise often you do black box analysis where you just see the system as a whole. Here you can look inside of it and you can spot every tiny detail which might let you trigger an issue. So that's one thing. And the other skills that are required is, I would just say, in a way, it's critical thinking. This skill is kind of hard to acquire, but you just have to have this security mindset where you think about all possible bad things that could happen here and all kinds of weird combinations.
Mm-hmm. Have you found, or have you ever worked with a hacker for your project?
Yes, we have some in the company. So yes,
those are white hat hackers.
Yeah, exactly, the white hat hackers. We have them in the company, and also we have worked with one. I guess he can also be considered a white hat hacker, who has won one of these bug bounties, which are given out from time to time. As a freelancer, we had the pleasure of working with some very smart and special people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. About the smart contracts that you see go through your platform, what kind of contracts are those mainly?
So initially we saw mainly ICO contracts because especially last year there. As is well documented, there was this enormous boom in smart contract in ICOs. But now more and more we see the shift from ICOs to actually building systems. So either the systems have the ICOs have raised enough money so that now the systems can be built, or companies have acquired funds in different ways and are now building actual functional systems on the blockchain that we are starting to audit now. And there we are seeing very, very interesting projects. And unfortunately, I cannot talk about all of them, but when I see them, I'm quite excited for the future.
Mm-hmm. But is there maybe, I mean, you said you've seen a shift away from ICOs, but I mean, just in general, away from ICOs to what? You know, shipping contracts, insurance contracts, what kind of smart contracts?
Yeah, so we have audited, for example, Augur, which is a big, very big prediction market, extremely interesting project. We have worked with DAO Stack, which allows you to kind of put together the pieces of an autonomous organization on the blockchain quite easily. And we are now working with other systems that try to provide actual concrete business cases on the blockchain, which of course is very interesting and very fascinating. And unfortunately, due to NDAs, I cannot talk about all of them yet.
Mm-hmm, sure. What kind of smart contracts do you think make most sense?
I mean, here I will refer to a paper also from Carl Wüst and Arthur Gervais, which is do you really need a blockchain? And that refers to the fact that not all applications actually fit the blockchain paradigm. So blockchain makes sense whenever you have kind of you have distrust in a way. So for example, if we have some kind of business together, but I don't fully trust you that you will do things correctly, then a smart contract can really help. And of course, it can also eliminate intermediaries. So what a lot of people say, what a great application will be for smart contracts in the future is insurance businesses, because in a way, what an insurance business is you're pooling risks and you're pooling your insurance payments. Mm-hmm. And very simplified, instead of an insurance company, you could just have a smart contract that is collecting all of your payments. And then if you, for example, you have to go to the hospital or you had a car crash, and then you can prove to the smart contract that you actually did have a car crash, then it can give you an automated payout. Mm-hmm. So that would, of course, be a very disruptive technology, I would say, as it would really change how we are currently doing insurances and how we are currently doing business in a way. So I think insurance is probably the prime market when we talk about how can really affect many people. Of course, in the end, people will not really know that things are happening on the blockchain. They will just use their app as they always do. And then in the background, things will happen on the blockchain, and therefore things will be a lot cheaper than they are at the moment. But we will see. Insurance is definitely one. Finance obviously has a lot of applications. So we'll see where it goes. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen any applications that had to do with information? I mean, because today I had an argument with somebody who said the only two, you know, useful and valid applications that actually need a blockchain, or where a blockchain makes sense, are currency and information. And what you just mentioned with the insurance contract, that's a currency example. But what about the information example?
Yeah, information is, of course, a very good topic, especially now that the new GDPR is coming out.
That stands for?
The General Data Protection Regulation. So this is the new European regulation that forces companies to handle data in a different way. And, for example, it gives customers the right to force companies to delete the data they have from that customer, which is a tricky thing if you have a blockchain, because there you typically cannot delete anything. So this is very, very interesting. So to come back to your question about information, the problem at the moment is that in blockchains like Ethereum, by default, everything is public. So, for example, let's say one possible use case could be I'm a researcher and now I have a really interesting data set, and now I want to put it on the blockchain, and whenever you use it, you need to pay a little bit. Mm-hmm. Technically, no problem at all. But at the moment that I put it on the blockchain, I have basically published it. So why would you pay for the use of it, and why would you not directly download it? We still see that the problem is that information is generally public on the blockchain, but we want to sometimes hide a part of that information to, for example, make a business model out of it, or because of privacy regulations. So here we still need to do research, but here there's also very interesting new things that are coming into play, such as zero knowledge proofs that allow us to do such magical business models. So I'm quite excited for the what the future will bring here, but we will have to see what exactly the information use cases will be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of challenges do you think still exist with these platforms that smart contracts run on?
I would say one of the biggest challenges scalability. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think almost all of these platforms have realized now. So if you start an Ethereum client now and you kind of do what you are supposed to do, you kind of start on the beginning of the blockchain and you try to catch up to current blockchain state, it will probably take you a couple of days. Of course, it always depends on what kind of computer you're using. But that is something tricky, that you need a couple of days to catch up with what has happened so far so that you can validate current transactions. And that's one problem. And the other problem is simply the amount of data that has to be stored at all times. So these blockchains are getting bigger and bigger. So if you want to store the current state of the Ethereum blockchain, you need, depending on how you store it, at between 50 and 200 gigabytes. So that also creates a lot of resources. And then also scalability in a way that, as is often famously mentioned, payment systems like Visa and MasterCard handle thousands of transactions per second, which systems like Bitcoin and Ethereum cannot do at the moment. They are more in the order of 10 transactions per second.
Do you think that is a design error or something that can be fixed at some point? Because the reason I'm asking this is I often hear when I speak with people about this that Ethereum as a project has been so ambitious that it was almost impossible to get right. And at some point, you know, there will have to be maybe a do-over or another solution to fix all these issues. What do you think?
Ethereum is actively evolving, which is probably a good thing for the space where it is. And there are solutions already, for example, to the catching up problem. I already mentioned the Parity company before. So the client of the Parity company offers you to kind of jump to a certain snapshot of the blockchain, and then you only need to catch up from that snapshot. So these are solutions that are being attempted. There's actually very interesting research into can you ignore old transactions? What can you ignore? Because often you don't necessarily care about everything that happened in the past. So I definitely think that something will have to happen here. If it's community-driven, like the Parity solution, where basically peers help other peers catching up, or whether it's kind of protocol-driven that Ethereum itself will say, like, we now have a completely new system, and that's why it's a lot easier to catch up now. We'll have to see which one of the two it will be. It's definitely clear that it's a non-trivial research problem to do this on the protocol level.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a possibility that all of this is going away at some point soon?
All of this, I don't think so. I agree with people who say this is kind of like the dot-com bubble. We first have to go through the bust, then we have to go through the long valley, and then the more substantial things will come out. That is probably true. As I've said, blockchain is not the solution to everything, and I kind of have to laugh at people who claim it is. But I think it's a good solution for certain problems. And these problems are quite important to our society, which is why I believe that it's going to be around forever, basically, in which amount we will see. I mean, I am very hesitant to say in 10 years, all of our banking transactions will be blockchain-based because, we don't know. And if time tells us anything, then change is sometimes slower than we expect. especially with big corporations. So I'm hesitant with this, but I definitely think that there's very unique opportunities that I'm very much looking forward to. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, imagine those opportunities that you just mentioned. Let's imagine that they came true, and all of a sudden, all of what we dreamed, you know, about what the blockchain can do has happened. What kind of world do you think that would be?
I think it would generally be a world that's not super different from what you have now. It's just a world where certain things are faster and certain things are cheaper than what you have now. Like, I mean, when you have, let's go back to an insurance example, an insurance claim will anyway be completely digital, and it will be handled quasi-automatic. So that will make it a lot faster, and it will make it also hopefully cheaper, which will bring down your insurance premiums and so on. Banking, I mean, now when I do a banking transaction, a regular one on a Friday evening, I have to wait until Monday morning until the bank actually transfers my money, which is something that is somehow feels a bit outdated. So that would go away. So I don't think that somehow honey will flow in the streets or something like this. But I think life is going to be slightly more convenient and slightly better. But then we'll get used to it, and then it's going to be the same as before.
Mm-hmm. Cool. How long do you think it will take until smart contracts are really as safe as, let's call it an offline contract that we know currently?
Yes. So I think here, as I said, the industry is kind of developing a lot. I mentioned before that we see a lot of beginners in this industry, but now more and more do we see structure. And I have already mentioned a couple of times the Parity company, which actually 2 weeks ago released a new blog article about how they have now completely new smart contract development processes. So this is something that I think will spread in the community. How do you build smart contracts? How do you review them? How do you audit them? Because also, as I said before, with audits, there's currently no standards, there's no guidelines, there's no minimum requirements. You could tomorrow start your own smart contract auditing business and say on Twitter that you're the greatest. And certainly there will be people coming to you, and you can issue them certificates how great their smart contracts are without any bugs. And no one will stop you. And this is definitely a tricky situation, because at the moment it's very hard for people to judge actual security. So we kind of need a security standard. In a way that we have security standards for cars, and we have security standards for other critical pieces of infrastructure. Because smart contracts will become critical pieces of infrastructure, we also need security standards for them. Mm-hmm.
Whose responsibility are those security standards?
I think they will come from the industry. So I think the industry has already realized and is realizing more and more that somehow everyone is sitting in one big boat. Because when the Parity wallet gets hacked, a lot of companies that use the wallet to store their funds are affected. And even companies that are not directly affected are indirectly affected by the reputational damage. So I think the community is realizing more and more that if security is generally increased, then actually we can have this value add that we're always talking about. But if we don't know if the smart contract that is handling all of our money is now secure, then of course it's not adding the value that we would like it to add.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Do you see some of those initiatives happening towards these standards?
Yes. So we are involved in some of them. We are trying to work with other players in the industry to kind of define what minimum standards should be for security. We are trying to also work with regulators to explain to them what minimum standards should be, what you should definitely do. In Switzerland, the Crypto Valley Association is quite big and influential, and it has also given out, for example, guidelines where it says we definitely recommend all of our members to get an audit before going public with their code. So we are seeing this first. I mean, we're kind of seeing this two-step process. First, we are seeing people agree you need an audit, and now we're seeing more and more that people agree the audit needs some kind of structure, and it probably needs some automated checking for certain properties, and it probably needs a specification and so on. And that's actually how you can also tell good from bad auditors. I mean, just look for specifications, look for what has been checked, look for the problem is you can't always look for what they found, because in a secure contract, you will not find anything, but look for past things if they ever found significant things and so on. So, there's definitely a lot of work to be done.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot for all this insight, and I wish you all the best with your project. And thanks a lot for taking time today.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.